പോളണ്ടിൽ എന്ത് സംഭവിച്ചു?
പോളണ്ടിനെ പറ്റി നീ ഒരക്ഷരം മിണ്ടരുത്.
Hi, Harsha. We're back.
We are. After a brief hiatus where I was taking an exam and you were doing some other stuff.
Yeah, work and health and all that fun stuff that gets in the way of the fun things we like to do. We're starting a series on historical films.
Yeah, which is very exciting because as I was telling you, the movie Pony and Selvin has just released the last couple of weeks. And I've just generally been in a space of being really into Indian history. I'm reading a lot about it. I'm listening to podcasts about it. Shout out to the podcast Echoes of India. That's really got me hooked on Indian history. And you were telling me about your theater experience watching Pony and Selvin because it was a crowded theater.
Oh, it was. And we were supposed to get the Tamil version here, but in southwestern Ontario, we have a situation where there are often kind of things happen at Tamil screenings.
I've heard about this, like attacks on theaters?
Yeah, they've like noxious substances and slashing of screens and things thrown at screens to, you know, wreck screens, which are not, you know, an inexpensive thing.
Yeah.
So it has been, there's kind of been an unofficial ban on Tamil language films in southwestern Ontario. And I don't know what it is about this region. It doesn't seem to happen anywhere else where Tamil films are screened. So they were trying to set up screenings for Pony and Selvin and all its various versions. And we were supposed to get the Tamil one right here. So like a theater 5 minutes from home. I was really excited. And then the theaters started getting threats, so they pulled it out.
And we're going to assume this has to do with the large population of Irim Thamars, southwestern Ontario, people from Sri Lanka.
Yeah, and some of it has been definitely fan-based. So for a while, it was only VJ films that these things happened at. So, you know, the anti-VJ fans. Okay. The VJ anti-fans.
The Stan Moores are like just offline now.
So like, that's been part of it. But there's also a little bit of jostling because there, you know, like there are in many places, a lot of community groups that form together to bring films in. And there's been a little bit of competition. And there's some feeling that maybe some of this comes out of that competition as well.
Mm.
You know, but it's very complicated. And it meant that in the end, we only got the Hindi dub of Pony and Selvin.
Oh, I've heard it wasn't very good.
Well, and like, I know people, some people love dubbed films and some people need dubbed films. That's, you know, absolutely fair. But for me, that's not the experience I want to have.
And it's two layers of languages you don't know, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Hindi, I can follow a little bit. Uh-huh. But it comes down to like voices and it's just another layer that distances me from the experience. So then we discovered that the Lightbox, TIFF's Lightbox in Toronto, was actually arranging screenings.
Cool.
So we don't normally make the big drive for movies, but Rob said, oh, hey, let's do this. So we did. So we went last Sunday and saw it. There was very tight security at the event.
Yeah.
We had to turn in our water bottles and they had a security guard in the theater at all times, which is sad. But on the other hand, it ensured that, you know, the films could go ahead and they were booked. Like the Lightbox was booked solid for a week and then they extended it for a week. I don't know if they're going to do any more. But even the Hindi dubs here, I would go in and check the seating and they were really well attended, which surprised me.
That's fascinating. I mean, sometimes like, you get like really big Bollywood movies that play in like the suburban theater, but where my parents live, like, as you said, like 5 minutes away. But this is like the first summer film I can think of. Maybe like also RRR, probably, I'm sure also was, and like maybe Vikram were like the big Tamil and Telugu movies that got played in those theaters. But yeah, the Pony and Selvin had so many showings in this Houston area. Like it's still playing in like theaters. It got like a release like a normal American movie almost, and like pretty much all of them were Tamil with English subtitles. So it was very exciting to be able to go to a movie without like having a lot of advanced planning, just showing up and getting tickets. Ours was packed because we went on a Sunday. I went with my parents, and nobody was throwing anything, but but like I was kind of distracted from the movie because the person sitting next to me really wanted my seat for her friend to come and chat with her. So that was like the only distracting thing. And I was like, this is why I don't go to movies where a lot of people want to see it. I only go to movies at 10 p.m. where I'm the only person in theater.
Well, it is. I mean, it is, on the other hand, kind of a fun experience because, you know, every time a new actor appeared on the screen, you know, there'd be cheers and whistles. And even for the women.
Yeah.
It was really fun. And I'd been a little concerned because I'd read the book and loved the book. And I know people, you know, for whom this book is very beloved and who were a little wary about what would happen. But when I watched the trailer, I went, this feels right. And yes, there are things that had to be dropped in an adaptation. I mean, it's a, what, you know, 2,200 page book and it's over two films. So Henry Rutnam was going to have to cut and adapt. My feeling was he did a really good job of that material. I felt the respect for the material in the film.
Yeah, I have not read the book. I have downloaded it now, one of the English translations. And I did read the Wikipedia entry before I went, which I think helped a lot because my mom was like reading the Wikipedia entry as she was sitting in the theater. My theater wasn't like, people are a lot more bougie than yours. So like there was no cheering, but like kids were just walking around and
yep.
So it was like a very communal experience. It wasn't like we're going to the movie, so everybody turn off your cell phones. And people are just like chatting like, oh, is this what it was in the book? People are just discussing stuff. Yeah, it was a very communal screening experience. And I want to rewatch it.
Yes.
Because I, you know, because of the person who was like trying to get my seat, it was like distracting me. I didn't understand some of the stuff that happened at the end. In the battle, and it had a very season finale ending,
yeah,
which didn't feel like a movie ending. And I think that's why I'm hearing a lot of, this could have been a great TV show instead of a movie.
I mean, I'm hearing that too, but I've boiled it down to, for me, he always said this was going to be two films. And if we could accept that kind of ending in Bahubali, for example, then why not accept it here?
Mm-hmm.
That works to, you know, sort things out in my head. That worked for me. I did wonder because, you know, Rob had not read the book, didn't have a lot of background of this, how he would follow all of these characters, because there are so many characters. And he did say afterwards that there were moments where he felt like a little bit lost, but then the film kind of caught him up. So he did really well and he actually enjoyed it too. So, you know, win for both of us. Particularly when, you know, this is my kind of passion and he comes along for the ride. And he, you know, he watches a lot of foreign language content alongside me and he likes it as well. So he's not just being dragged along against his will, but, you know, it's a commitment and he has to drive into Toronto and find us parking and all of that stuff. So it's always nice when the person doing that enjoys the film as well.
Yeah. I would say if you like Gladiator, all these big historical movies, this is in that very much in that genre. For those of us who are not Tamil speakers, or Tamil readers, we don't have the same emotional connect because it's not something like,
yes.
It's not something that, you know, multiple generations of our family have read and loved. But I think even for me as a Malayali, part of the general bigger Tamaragam, we know who Rajaraja Chola is, who Rajendra Chola is. So I think you know, we could connect on that level, but this is just a fun historical movie and you get to see some very good actors, you know, do some excellent work. For me, seeing Vikram in a movie where he's not the best part of it, where everybody else is pulling their weight, is a treat because he's usually in movies where he's often the only thing going for that movie.
And I'm one of these rare people, I don't actually care for Vikram as an actor.
Okay.
But I did enjoy him in this. I thought he suited the role really well. And I think for me, because there was this really big cast, that it wasn't all dependent on him, that he worked for me for a change. Like, I really had a blast and I would love to be able to see it again. At this point, I'm going to have to wait for streaming because there's no way I'm doing another trip into Toronto, but it was definitely worth it. And I also, and this is something that will come up, I think, as we talk more about these films. I also appreciated the care that went into the production. I was reading, you know, articles from the people who did the costume design and the jewelry design, and because they didn't have a great sense, because this is what, 10th century?
Yeah.
But it's long enough ago that they wouldn't have had a strong sense of what people wore. So they had to go, I was struck when I saw the trailer, because I went, it looks like the sketches in the book. Mm. And the costume designer said that they did use that as a base, so that people would feel kind of familiar, having already, if they've read the book, already having seen the types of clothing that the book suggests. But simply the level of care, and that, you know, contrasts for me, because I also watched in the last few weeks RRR, which I did not enjoy. It's actually...
You're falling into the Twitter pit of comparing RRR to Funny and Selfish.
I don't know. And actually, I don't want to, except for on this level of detail in terms of costumes, because one of the things that really pulled me out of RRR were the costumes for the Western actors, which were not period.
I haven't seen the movie, but I've obviously seen the song videos on YouTube. And this isn't my problem with... not just RRR, it's with Lagan, it's with Madrasipatnam. Everything looks like every community theater costumes, which is fine, I think, for Indian population. But for a lot of us who have watched a lot of BBC costume dramas, we know the level of detail that tailoring that goes into those outfits, you know, the women's bustles and things like that. So it looks very... I don't know, the late 1800s, early 1900s British costumes always look very community theater.
Yeah, my comment on Twitter was that they opened the Halloween catalog for Edwardian woman, and that's what you had. And this is not the Edwardian period. And I went, actually, if there's good to come out of this, I actually went searching for stuff on costume designing. And one of the videos that I watched was for Miss Fisher Mysteries, which is set in the 1920s. Yep. Now, I wouldn't have expected the kind of level of detail to the costuming in RRR as they did with Miss Fisher. Mm-hmm. But I used it as an example of how you may not be able to afford those kinds of period pieces, and that's fair, but... you could look at that period in terms of what kind of shapes and silhouettes the clothing were. And I think you could do better.
Yeah.
You know, even doing it a little on the cheap, you could get the shapes right.
I think you're specifically addressing the fact that a lot of the women's costumes were floor length, when this was the era when they were knee length or below the knee, right?
Well, even the shapes as well. I mean, everything about those costumes was clearly, you know, some sort of flavor of Edwardian England.
Yeah.
And it just kept hitting me in the face. And they would be wearing these, you know, what would be literally fancy dresses for day dresses. And it just kept pulling me out. And it was such a little thing. I had other issues with the film as well, but I think that just kind of ruined it for me. And I'm very much alone.
It didn't ruin a lot of people's experience.
No, but it's, you know, for something like that. And I don't have... I honestly, again, we'll get to this in some of the films we talk about. I honestly don't have very high expectations, but some kind of minimal standard. Because, I mean, we're going to get into, too, the whole fact that if you have Western actors, they're not going to be great actors. And again, you know, that's budgets and, you know, you're not going to attract an A-list actor, Western actor, to an Indian film. That's just the reality. It's an unfortunate reality, but, you know, they have to work with what they can do. And that much I get. So I do try to cut a lot of slack in those areas. But yeah, this just didn't work for me.
Since the death of Tom Alter, there hasn't been a good white actor to play random colonialists in Indian cinema.
Yeah, but again, like somebody like Tom Alter literally grew up in India and lived in India and spoke apparently Hindi. Impeccable Hindi. And had a love for the place. So he could bring something a little more to those roles too. And simply being there and available is part of the deal too. But yeah, so I'm always going to cut some slack on that, because it's just not going to be possible to have, you know, but it does stand out a bit, though, you know.
Speaking of white actors, and actually the costume designer of Punyan Selvan, Ika Lakhani, we can maybe start talking about Urumi, because there's some connections to Urumi there.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Urumi today and Swati Tirunam.
Yes. So Urumi, just to start off with, is the story of Vasco da Gama's initial attempts to gain a foothold in what is now the Malabar region, which at that time was divided into two kingdoms, one ruled by the Kolaridi and one ruled by the Samudri, the Zamorin. And so this has to do with da Gama's interactions with the Kolaridi rulers of Kannur. And so there, the movie starts with a young man in present-day India who is trying to sell off an ancestral property to a multinational mining corporation. And as he's home to do the paperwork and get through some red tape to sell his property, he gets kidnapped by a bunch of insensitively depicted indigenous people, Adivasis, and is told the story of his ancestor, who was, during the time of Vasco da Gama, one of the people fighting against Portuguese incursions into Kerala. And he gets this whole story of how his ancestor decides he needs to kill Vasco da Gama, and he basically mounts a rebellion against him. And that's what the story is about, unless you want to fill in some details.
No, and that is, I mean, at the time they were marketing it as a, you know, the first global Malayalam film. I actually find that kind of interesting to think back on this film and how these days, in the last couple of years, you had this emphasis on pan-Indian films. And it is generally these big blockbuster historical period type of movies that do that. So here we have, you know,
big star cast.
Yeah. Same kind of thing. You have Arya, you have Tabu, you have Vidya Balan.
Janelia D'Souza. Prabhudeva.
Yeah, so you have this cast, big cast, across a number of industries. And for me, that was kind of the first time seeing that. So they were breaking some ground with this film. This was actually the first film Malayalam film I ever saw in a theater. And I saw it without subtitles. And then I saw it again with subtitles when the DVD came out. And I have not watched it since. I don't think it aged well.
It didn't. That's what surprised me on a rewatch. And part of it is it's really hard to get a Malayalam version of this on streaming. You can only get the Hindi dub in a lot of the places I look. So I was watching it in Hindi after, you know, having initially watched it in Malayalam.
Well, to be honest, my DVD version was from Moser Bear. So it's, you know, the subtitles are not great and they have their Moser Bear banners. And it's like no loss that Moser Bear disappeared. Because their DVDs were dreadful, except, you know, they probably had a catalog that we all would love to have access to now. But yeah, I remembered enjoying the film at the time. And normally for the podcast, I will watch the films we're going to watch a couple of times at least. I could not go back and watch Urumi again. And some of it, honestly, was the camera work. I was really surprised at some of the shots were very, very tight. So many shots of people's eyes. Like we joke about eye acting, but there were like these intense close up on eyes. And I was like, what?
I kept noticing that Prithviraj's eyes are not symmetrical. And I was like, that's not the eyes of a handsome man. And I was like, but he's overall very handsome. So I'm very confused at the close ups on his eyes.
And the budget for Cole on this film must have been through the roof. Gorgeous color sense, like as you would expect from Santosh Sivan, good cinematography, good color grading palette. It reminded me of, what was the film we watched for the Supernatural series?
Anandabhadram? Yes. I was also making comparisons because everything has that like slightly damp sort of haziness to it.
That's very Santosh Sivan.
Uh-huh.
Water, wet, reflective surfaces, mists, haze, that's like all his hallmarks. But even the color palette too, like the slate grays and the yellows and the saffrons and orange and golds. And
which I assumed was also because of the dyes that were available. You know, I heard Ika Lakhani talking a lot about the research he had done into what dyes were available during the 10th century along the trade and what trade route. So I assumed a lot of that in Urumi as well, that she had looked into what would have been available at the time.
Which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, visually the film, apart from, you know, some of the tight camera angles that made me feel very claustrophobic this time watching it. You know, if I make my comparison to RRR and the Western costumes there, I don't think the costumes for Vasco da Gama and Esteban were 100%, but I think they were close enough, if you know what I mean.
They were okay. The wigs were the problem for me, for everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody's wigs were just...
How many times do we complain about wigs in historical dramas?
Prithviraj has, like, the worst luck with wigs. Who is his wig man? Like, his hair looks so ratty, and I think, like, Prithviraj is a handsome man, and I think that's not the issue. It's just I was also comparing this to, like, the elaborate hair stuff that we had going on in Punyan Selvan.
Yeah.
And, like, how nice Vikram's hair actually looks, even though he's, like, a soldier, and, like, they could have gotten away with a ratty wig, but they really did a good job doing the men's hair, because... unfortunately, men's hair don't get the attention that it deserves in a lot of movies, especially Malayalam cinema. That's why we have the Siddiq wig movie quality chart. You need to trademark this.
Yeah, well, it works a lot of the time. But, I mean, some of this comes down to money, too. And I got thinking, you know, some of these tight action shots, like the tight camera angles on the action shots, were to cover up probably that they couldn't afford really good action choreography. And you know what? You do what you have to do in this case to make your money go as far as you need it to go. A lot of slow-mo shots. I didn't remember that the first time through, but so much slow motion.
I did notice at the start, I assumed it was to show the Urumi moving.
Yes, yeah.
Because that's sort of the central motif of this movie. Because, yeah, it is very beautiful to watch the Urumi being used. The other thing that it's been so long since I first watched this movie that I forgot, but it reminded me again that I don't like Janelia's acting.
Yeah.
She does a lot of, how do I describe it? Telugu Tamil manic pixie girl acting in this movie, where she's either, you know, at the start where she's playing a character in contemporary Kerala, where she's sort of intellectually not fully an adult, versus what she was in the past, where she's just kind of making like a pouty face, when she's supposed to be ferocious.
Yeah, and that is too bad, because, you know, technically that's like a good character. You have a woman warrior, which is, you know, really interesting. She just doesn't have the chops to give the weight to that role, unfortunately. This was the film, though, that had me looking at Jagadish Srikumar for the first time and going, hey, he is much more than a comedy uncle. Like, whoa, he was really good in this. That's when I started sort of searching out more films with him to find things that weren't just, you know, comedy uncle sidekick roles.
He plays the prime minister, or one of the sort of privy council members, advisors of the Koladri king. And he's sort of this effeminate, gay-coded man who's using some of his semi-feminine wiles with the king. He's kind of making pawn for him and things like that in a, you know, typical feminine role. He's a supporter of Da Gama and wants more Portuguese interference into the kingdom.
Actually, let me take a little bit of a step back too, because before we started, I was talking about how I can approach these films as an outsider. And I did a degree in history, and I did a course on sort of the great explorers. So I learned this history, but from a Western colonizer perspective, which was that, you know, Da Gama was doing great things and, you know, bringing pepper to the rest of the world and blah, 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 blah. This was probably one of the first times that I had a chance to take a step back and go, wait, that history is written from a perspective that has really changed since I went to university. I find the same thing with my Canadian history courses too. when I studied, it was all colonizer settler history. And now you have access to courses, the same history from a First Nations perspective, and it's very eye-opening. So this is what Urumi did for me, was make me take a step back and say, hang on, there were incredibly organized, complex societies here already, and what was this guy doing, you know, barreling in with his ships to grab all the spoils and treat these people badly? So it really was, you know, if that's what these films are helping do, is reframe, and they were consciously trying to do that too, using the, you know, the idea of globalization, the global mining company, and how globalization is like kind of like the new colonization. That is actually an interesting thing that they were trying to do with this film, and that has got me over the years, you know, trying to take a step back. And any time that a film will make me go, actually, every one of the films we're going to talk about this series, because it's a history that I either don't know or that I know from a different perspective that needs to be challenged, these films have me constantly thinking about what I know, what I think I know, and what I clearly don't know.
So I mentioned before, my primary school education was mostly in Indian schools. And some of the colonial history was in there, but still all I remember from my social studies books was Vasco da Gama came to the Malabar coast for peppers. But in the culture I grew up in the Malayali culture, we have songs mocking Vasco da Gama, sort of a colloquial song. So he is a kind of hoity-toity clownish figure in Malayalam sort of culture in general. So I did know this about Urumi, that he was not a good guy from our perspective. I guess what I got was the nuance that you always hear, oh, all these small kingdoms were fighting with each other and jostling for power. And that created tensions that Europeans could exploit to their own advantage. And that's a lot of what is shown in this movie. I did read some stuff that said that the way it's depicted here is not what happened, because the Samudhi was the one who was very against the British, and the Koladhiri was actually quite favorable to, not the British, I'm sorry, Samudhi was the one against the Portuguese, and the Koladhiri was the one who was quite pro-Portuguese. And that there couldn't have been that much of a dispute between the Arakil family and the Chirakil family, because the Arakil Bivis were descended from the Chirakil house. So they considered each other relations. And for what it's worth, the Arakil family is the only ruling Muslim family of Kerala. So there's a lot of nuances to this story that might not actually be what happened in history, but it does kind of get you the general gist that it's because of all this jostling for power between each of us that the Portuguese got the chance to come and take over.
Yeah, I only wish that Da Gama had not been portrayed as a giggling loon. From what I have read, he was incredibly ruthless, and I would have no qualms about that depiction at all. The opening scene where there's like a mass killing, that's actually recorded history. That did happen, where he has them slice off the ears of the messenger and sew the dog's ears on, is, I believe, just a story. But given how ruthless he was, it certainly could have happened. But then that comes down to, you know, the issue of the actors again. So I kind of set it aside, because I'm fine with you reframing this history to show how ruthless these people were coming in. I take steps back now. And again, I go back to that course I took, which was how wonderful it is that these people took off for places unknown and took these risks and blah, 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 blah. And I guess on the one hand, yeah, I can see that, but we don't, it's getting better, but we need to go farther in reframing what they actually did and the consequences of these, quote, wonderful exploits. So for me, a film like Urumi at least gets us thinking in those directions.
You know, I don't know about the whole cutting off ears and sewing on dog's ears, but the cutting off body parts, maiming people, this is very much a piece with purported history of what the Spanish, the Portuguese, yep, did in South America, what the Belgians did in Africa. So it's clear that some of this is taken from the general history of European colonization and what was acceptable to do, what was, you know, by civil, quote unquote, civilized countries towards the uncivilized nations they took over.
Yeah, anyone out there who could see me, I'm rolling my eyes because...
Yes, and I'm making air quotes around civilized and uncivilized.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, we do need to challenge these notions and keep challenging them.
Yeah. So Prithviraj, I feel, did a solid job because this is very much up his alley of roles. It's at the beginning and the end where he's playing a kind of casual young man of today where, you know, that we've discussed this. He as an actor is not very good with lightness.
Yeah.
So he has to play a sort of light character and, you know, make funny faces because he's been kidnapped by scary Adivasis. And that is not as convincing. But what he does in the proper 1400s chunk of this movie, he's very much playing this buff, fierce warrior who's, you know, rescuing girls, beating up Europeans, and putting people in their place. That is a very satisfying hero figure. Yeah. He plays a character called Chirikil Kelunainar. And this person apparently did exist in real life. But obviously, Shankar Ramakrishnan, the scriptwriter, has taken a lot of liberties with his life story and why he wants to kill Dagama and why he died in the first place. And Prabhudeva probably is the most solid core of this movie.
Yes.
He's very good in the sort of bookend parts in the contemporary era versus in the past as well. You know, you get the benefit of having a very experienced hand playing his character because he's kind of the sidekick, but he brings a lot of pathos to that role as well.
Yeah, and he brings what Prithviraj can't bring, you know, playing this solid, solemn warrior.
Yes.
So it's nice that we've got them to play off each other with what's going on.
Yeah, because Prithviraj is very fearless warrior, but he's not a swashbuckling. And Prabhudeva gets to do a little bit of more like light swashbuckling. And he gets to flirt with the girls, with Nithya Menon's character. I really love their portions.
Yes.
Because they're both very into each other. And he's like, this girl is into me too. In the parts where she's flirting with him. Nithya Menon plays a noble woman, a princess, the king's daughter, the Koladiri's daughter. So, and she decides that she has taken a fancy to these two guys who rescue her, but specifically Prabhudeva from some enemies. And Prabhudeva plays a Muslim character. It's clear that he's not as high caste as Prithviraj's character, but she kind of has her heart set on him.
It's very cute.
Yes, and the Chimichimi song is also very cute.
Yeah, the songs are wonderful. The songs held up for me.
Yep, they did. They did.
Yep. Other bits didn't, unfortunately.
I think it's still a solid watch, but what it represented in 2011 was very much of its time.
Yes.
You know, it was definitely an event to go watch this movie and to have all these, you know, pan-Indian stars come together to make a movie that is fundamentally of Malayalam cinema. And it, you know, it was the dawn of August cinemas.
Yes. The other unfortunate thing is in the portions of the film where, at the beginning, where Arya's character kidnaps Prithviraj to start telling him the story of his ancestors. For some reason, they couldn't get Arya in to dub those. So Prithviraj dubbed them. So you have Prithviraj and Prithviraj. And it's, oh, that's interesting. So I think, you know, they were really doing the best they could with the money they had with this production. And at a time when really nobody was thinking this far into doing this kind of film with these, you know, casts from across Indian industries. And they had big plans for it. They were going to do an English language version. Nothing ever came of it, but they did have big plans to go further with the film at the time.
Mm. Yeah, I read something on the Wikipedia about that, and it was going to be a bit more of a Dagama biopic, then it was going to be...
Which would be unfortunate.
Yeah.
Depending on how they did it. But, well, and there was the plagiarism suit for one of the songs.
Oh, I've never heard of this.
Yeah. Oh, which song is it? Ara, Ara.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ara me, Ara me. That one.
Yeah. And it's all the slow motion leaping and warrior stuff.
Oh, maybe not that one.
No, no. But it is, it's very obvious, and it has a Canadian connection because there was a suit filed by Lorena McKinnitt.
I know Lorena McKinnitt, yes. Arro is the song you're talking about, yeah.
And I was listening to the both of them back to back last night, and I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think she won that suit, I think. They were unable to release any of the soundtracks in other languages other than Malayalam because of the suit.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't make the connection, but I've heard a lot of Lorena McKinnitt, and that song definitely sounds like Lorena McKinnitt.
Oh, yeah. It was really obvious. It wasn't just sort of, you know, little bits. It was like the whole sweep of the song. And she's very well known for like folk and Celtic. And she explores not only what we would consider like Irish or Scottish Celtic stuff, but she explores from France and Spain and places where you would have, like particularly in Spain, where you would have Arabic influences in the Celtic music as well. So her music is very unique. And I do think she's actually someone who keeps track of her image or has people do it. So, you know, things might have slipped under the radar at some point with somebody else and somebody else's music. But I think they just got the perfect time to be caught by it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's the first time I'm hearing about it.
So I do wonder what that did to, because if they, you know, if they couldn't release soundtracks in other languages and like what else couldn't they do, and did that, was that the start of sort of taking the air out of the balloon they were trying to lift here with this? Because they, you know, we keep coming back to it. They were trying to do something really different, unique, and special at this time in Malayalam cinema. And things we are seeing, you know, 10 years on that are bearing more fruit now.
Yeah. I always think that currently what Malayalam cinema is doing in sort of the national, you know, in the national role it's playing in Indian cinema is what Prithviraj envisioned 10, 15 years ago and what he was talking about. Unfortunately, it's been partly because of a decline in Hindi cinema's importance and, you know, what it's bringing to the audience. So Malayalam cinema kind of had a void to step into. And not just because, I recently shared this on Twitter, is not just because Hindi cinema fundamentally does have a lack of fresh talent because the families have a monopoly on star power in that industry. It's also because of the government in India right now keeping a boot on Hindi cinema's neck. So they're not able to do interesting things the way Malayalam cinema is allowed to do, partly because it has a government that doesn't interfere as much. You know, in a lot of ways, Kerala and Tamil Nadu get a lot of the brunt of the national Hindutva anger about the kind of things that the culture in Kerala and Tamil Nadu being a little bit anti-Hindutva. So, but because of the overall culture being a little bit more independent from the Modi government, I think they're able to kind of keep doing these movies that aren't influenced as much by the government. But there's a really interesting article in the Washington Post this week about how much the Modi government has been interfering in Bollywood.
Yeah, and everybody I know who shared that article got descended on by the bots. And
oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it was a really interesting read. But, you know, to wrap it back around to Prithviraj, he has, as you indicated, he has been in interviews for years and years and years saying that Malayalam cinema deserves a wider audience.
And it has the content for it. People just can't access it.
Yeah. And, you know, people at some point would like poo-poo him, like, but he was like, no, we can do this. There is no reason we can't have a bigger presence. And I think, you know, the last few years are proving him very right.
Yeah, the minute people started being able to access a lot of the movies on streaming with subtitles, the fans just started coming in, the movie watchers started coming in. And, you know, it's gotten to a point where it's almost cliche or pandering where you're like, oh my God, Malayalam cinema is the best in India. I'm like, shut up. Like, you're just saying what everybody's saying, which is the very cynical Malayali in me being like, you're just a bandwagon jumper.
Yeah, but we're also seeing, we're seeing it not only in Malayalam cinema, we're seeing these improvements in Tamil and Kannada cinema particularly. I mean, yes. Kannada has had kind of a little root of very good films and filmmakers and people involved as well, but they just never seem to have enough of it. And lately you have like the three Shetties who are out there making films and making really great films. And some of them, you know, bigger budget and some of them smaller, region-centered kind of films.
Yeah, Kannada cinema for the longest time was sort of the like ugly stepchild that the other South Indian cinema. I mean, you know, Tamil and Telugu could always say we have big budgets and big fan bases, and Malayalam could say we have the content. And Kannada quite didn't quite have an identity in between those three. But now, you know, it's got KGF, it's got Kantara, it definitely is developing a stronger identity than it has in the past. And actually a lot of people who are not, you know, native Kannadigas, you know, we're having a lot of Tulu speaking actors who are, you know, people from the Bund community who are actually becoming Kannada stars. And I think that it's very interesting to think about how Karnataka itself is kind of divided linguistically between Kannada, Konkani and Tulu and Bihari, some of these other smaller languages that exist in that state. And I felt like that's part of the reason it's always had a hard time. Yep. Kannada cinema has always had a hard time dominating.
Yeah, and when I'm thinking of what good Kannada films I've seen, a lot of them have been kind of art house films that would have gone to festivals.
Like Pallavi Anupallavi is the only Kannada movie I can think of from like the past couple of decades.
I saw one called The Turtle. I don't know what the title was in Kannada, but a very art house film. I saw it at TIFF. But good, really good films. So, you know, potential for some good films out of there. But I didn't expect to see what I've seen out of the last year, couple of years out of Kannada cinema. And it's really great. And again, to loop it back around to historicals, if historical films and period films allow people to reclaim their history, and that's part of what they're doing in all of this storytelling and why we're starting to see some of these films throughout all of these industries. Like, it's a really good time. And it's a good time for them too, because, you know, there are budgets for them and there are technological advances, which means the films look much better. So it's not surprising that you have sort of this confluence of all of these things happening right at this time. And we're seeing a bunch of great big period/historical films.
And specifically, a lot of this stuff is happening in the South, because what's happening in Bollywood is that Akshay Kumar is making a lot of historicals, and they're not great because they have a very firm point of view, and it's not necessarily one that's interested in entertaining as much as inspiring you with jingoism.
Yep.
So that's the we are getting a lot of historical films, but there's definitely a divide between the ones that are becoming a hit with people versus the ones that are not.
Yep.
That are kind of very much there to serve an agenda.
Yep.
And RRR kind of does a little bit of both.
Asim Burney from the Khandan podcast calls those films jingoracles.
Yes, I've been listening to the Khandan podcast, and I'm picked up on the jingorical term.
It's a good phrase.
It's very funny. It's a very funny phrase.
And it's very apt.
Yeah.
And but you know, that was the thing that struck me, particularly reading that Washington Post article this week too, is that those films are not doing well.
The last one I can think of was the Mission Mango movie that Akshay Kumar did, which I also saw in theaters. And that was actually a genuinely good movie. It had a good cast. But, you know, there's this joke that people in India are now afraid of doing anything great or admirable because they're afraid Akshay Kumar is going to make a movie based on what they did.
I mean, in some ways, it's really sad. But on the other hand, we now have other industries to go and enjoy. So I got into Malayalam films because of Bollywood. So I do have some affection. I have some very great affection for some of the older masala films. So it is kind of sad to see this happening and history represented in ways that is kind of troubling.
Because I think even, you know, people whose allegiances might be more towards the BJP or right-wing government are picking up on the inherent falseness in some of these movies, that they're not there to entertain them, but they're there to make them feel certain ways that are, you know, that are meant to serve political power. And I think that's where this kind of interference really goes wrong.
Yeah. So maybe we should turn to the second film now, which is a lot less... Let's just turn to the second film.
Yeah, the second film is Swathi Thirunal, which is about the Travancore king. So we're going from northern Kerala all the way to southern Kerala. And we're going from the 1400s to the 1800s. And Swathi Thirunal was one of the kings of Travancore, who was also a big fan of the arts. He was very into music, classical music and classical dance. He's supposedly one of the people who was really influential in Mohiniyattam being the current art form that it is. Check out the blog Cinema Nrityakarana, which is a fan of Indian cinema who writes about classical dance in Indian cinema. She does a really good job talking about this movie specifically and the classical dances in it. But yeah, he was also a reformer. He established public libraries in Trivandrum. He established English medicine. Still today in Kerala, allopathic medicine is called English medicine because it's the English doctors who first started administering it. But he was also, died very young. He died in his 30s. And he was kind of a pivotal figure in keeping the Kingdom of Travancore a British protectorate rather than, you know, becoming a full colony the way the rest of India became. Because if you look at a map of British rule of India, you'll see all of it, British colonies up till Malabar, which is where the Samudri and the Koladri ruled. That became, those two regions became Malabar. And then it's the Kingdom of Kochi and the Kingdom of Travancore that remained independent and just kind of called British protectorates. So he was a significant figure in that. The movie is very heavily loaded with music and a dance scene. So literally every 5 minutes, there's a song break. Often live performance, so it's not as if he's dancing around a tree or anything like that. It kind of revolves around his couple of decades of rule, where he's surrounded by his prime minister, his queen, who is not his wife, it's his aunt, and his wife, who he is very in love with at first, but then he takes a mistress who's a dancer, and then there's conflict between his queen and him that apparently leads to his death. Because he's heartbroken. It's not entirely sure to me why he died early. They didn't really go into it in the movie.
This is one I watched without subtitles. And for me, the fact that it was heavily music and dance was a plus. It's also, I mean, the print on Hotstar was pretty dismal. But you can see that there was some really good filmmaking going on with this film. Like, the cinematography is really lovely. And I can only imagine what it would have looked like in a good print. But this was also my first exposure to the Kingdom of Travancore and this figure who I knew nothing about, and which I went, I really should know more about, because of, you know, how everything I've read talks a lot about his interest and support of the arts. There's a point in the film where he says to the English viceroy, or, you know, whoever from the East India Company is in charge or whatever, they want him to get rid of some of the musicians or artists from his court for political reasons, and he doesn't want to do it because he sees them only as artists and wants what they can bring in terms of art to his kingdom.
Yeah, there's a whole plot line in the movie where this person is called the resident.
Yes, yeah.
The person, the representative of the British East India Company, where he's asking for reports of how the treasury is spending its money. And the king, Swathi Thirunal, is spending a lot of money on his artists. And so there's some conflict where the king refuses to give a report to the British East India Company. And his aunt, the queen, is advising him to not pick fights with the British because they, you know, the East India Company has basically taken over most of India. And, you know, they could at any time take over Travancore because they have so much debt towards the East India Company. And he, you know, at some point he says, the king of Travancore is considered the servant of Sri Padmanabha, the patron god of Trivandrum. And instead he says, I'm not the servant of Sri Padmanabha, I'm the servant of the East India Company. Sort of this biting comment to his aunt who's trying to get him to make peace with the company. And so there's a lot of political machinations that are happening. It's not like anybody's plotting or anything. It's just that his aunt has who was his regent for a very long time before he achieved the majority, has a very strong point of view of how she's going to keep her relations up with the British. And he does not want to, you know, give an inch with them.
Well, and again, the East India Company is something that in recent years, people have been taking another look at in terms of what they did in India. William Dalrymple has written a book called The Anarchy, which is actually quite negative in terms, I shouldn't say negative, it's perhaps more honest in its perceptions of what the East India Company did and what it was trying to do, along with other, like the French and the Dutch were trying to colonize as well. So there is this opportunity again with a film like this to take a second look at, I had not heard of the Kingdom of Travancore again. You know, I'm getting the history from the perspective of the East Indian Company went in and, you know, sent wonderful goods back to the West and brought order to India, blah, 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 all the usual stuff you hear, which, again, we've got to be challenging those. I don't know how many times I can say it, but, you know, it's the truth. We have to constantly keep challenging these narratives. The one thing I was really disappointed that I couldn't find was my copy of The Ivory Throne by Manu S. Pillai, who is one of these people who is now doing a lot of writing on this history. And the book apparently was optioned for, you know, film, the rights for film. So it will be very interesting to see if they do, because it's the same, you know, the two women, his mother and his aunt, Gauri Parvatibai and Gauri Lakshmibai. I would really love to know more about them. And that would be, like, for me, that would be a really interesting film.
Swati Thirunal is still a very beloved figure, especially in Trivandrum. It's a lot of things named after him. There's a lot of things named after various members of the Travancore royal family. And, you know, they're kind of considered very revolutionary in their approaches to public services to citizens. And a lot of the Kerala government's post-1950s commitment to education and healthcare, a lot of it is supposed to have stemmed from the commitments the royal family made in the first place. That typically it's the royal family that gets a lot of credit, and, you know, missionaries generally doing a lot of work. Both of those kind of play a role in what the Kerala government eventually started providing. And that's one of the reasons that Kerala has a high quality of life and index. And the other thing is, in this movie, they make the sort of matrilineal system of inheritance that exists in Travancore, in Kochi, in Malabar, much clearer. Because in Urumi, I feel like a lot of Malayalam filmmakers are very hesitant to show how matrilineal systems look, because you inherit from your mother, not from your father. Sort of in Urumi, it makes no sense how the prince, the king's son, is the one who wants to inherit on his behalf, because there would be no way. It would be his nephew who would become king instead of the son. So this movie shows matrilineal systems of inheritance a lot more clearly than a lot of other historical Malayalam movies, where I think there's an attempt in some ways to cover up how matrilineal systems work, either because it's confusing or because as part of Kerala's throwing off caste systems, they threw away matrilineality as well. Matrilineality is still much stronger in Travancore than it is in the rest of Kerala. So you see a lot of that in this movie, where his mother is the queen, and she's actually the ruler as well. She's the reigning queen, when he's born because there's no man to inherit at that time. When she gives birth to him, he immediately becomes a king, but he cannot rule because he's a baby. So she rules on his behalf. And then when she dies, his aunt becomes the queen and she rules on his behalf. In that way, it's brothers and sisters who become kings and a pair of kings and queens rather than husbands and wives.
Yeah, even I got that without subtitles.
Okay, great.
But I've also been having over the years to do more and more reading. And, you know, you explain this to us on the podcast all the time, too. So that's, you know, that's always helpful. Because really, there are some days when I'm kind of at sea in terms of what I'm seeing. So I just, you know, I just think it's a really good opportunity to go and, you know, learn some things. So, you know, if in our exploration here, you know, if we're encouraging people like me to learn some things, I, you know, that's always good in my book.
The other thing that I learned from watching this movie, which I didn't realize, was two of very famous songs that I think a lot of Malayalis know. Omana Tingal Kidavo, which is a lullaby, was written for Swati Thirunal. And the sort of this song that a lover sings, Prananadhan, is also written for Swati Thirunal by his wife. So I didn't realize that two of these famous compositions were both had to do with this one figure. And this movie does show you that these two compositions were about him. And he also, you know, there's like various scenes in this movie where you see Carnatic musicians dueling with Hindustani musicians. And also you see Kaidapuram Damodaran Nambudiri, the lyricist, he's playing an actual singer in this movie. So he's often in a lot of scenes in the musical scenes. It's very heavy with semi-classical compositions.
Yep.
If people are interested in that sort of thing.
I am, but, you know, I obviously know very little. And it's often, oh, this is really lovely to listen to. But again, you know, if it's going to spark learning, I'm there for it.
Yeah, and I noticed a lot of the songs were praises to Sri Padmanabha, even the Hindi ones, even though he's not someone North Indians would typically think of as a god to pray to. So some of these compositions were clearly made for Swati Thirunal himself. The other thing is the ages were kind of weird in this movie because he's depicted at 16 looking fully like a 40-year-old man. And then Srividya, who plays his aunt, is much younger than the actor playing Anantnag. So I wasn't exactly sure why Anantnag was the actor who was chosen to play this figure.
Well, he's a Kannada actor too.
Yes, he's not a Malayali. He didn't dub for himself in this movie.
Yeah, because I had never seen him before and I went, okay, who is he? And went looking him up and went, oh, okay, why?
Yeah, no, I don't understand what his particular... I mean, I can think of quite a few Malayali actors who could have played the role, but maybe that his particular, you know, he's like a tall, skinny kind of guy.
Yep.
So maybe that's what they were going for with you know, the way Swati Thirunal has been shown in paintings and stuff. That's kind of what he looks like, a tall, skinny guy with a big bun on the side. And this is directed by Lenin Rajendran, who's even from Malayalam cinema, he's kind of an art film director.
Yeah. You can see it in this film.
Yeah, this was not meant for a big popular audience. This was definitely meant for the art film circuit.
But again, a nice little bit of history that I'm learning about and an interesting film. My only, you know, again, I couldn't find it with subtitles. And it's actually something I would recommend because I found it kind of compelling to watch and the music was lovely. But again, I'm looking at it going, things get subtitled. The things that don't get subtitled are obviously things that are aimed at an audience that is not me.
Yeah.
So, you know, the average person looking at Malayalam films might not choose a film about Swati Thirunal.
This is definitely sort of, we're very much in the weeds of Malayalam cinema.
Very much insider baseball, as they say.
Yeah, because what you're looking for, thinking about is, hey, if you've seen a bunch of, you know, those Mohanlal films of the 90s where there's a lot of semi-classical and classical music and dance, this is a lot of where that history is drawing from. Because Mohanlal himself is a little bit like Swati Thirunal. He loves classical architecture. He loves classical music. He loves classical dance. So he is kind of drawing from this, you know, 19th century tradition of courtly dance and music. And a lot of what South Indians especially are proud of in terms of Carnatic music and, you know, the various classical dances hold over, you know, even the youngest people, you know, the youngest generation being trained in these dances come from Swadhinidanal and that era of sort of rediscovering Indian arts. Because it's not the same in the north. There's not as much classical influence in the day-to-day person's life. And even a lot of North Indians will learn Bharatanatyam instead of learning a North Indian dance because there's just more teachers. There's just a like a stronger bench of talent and education to learn from.
Well, and even in contemporary music, you'll still get people saying, oh, I use this raga as the base for this. So you still get a lot of that. And I don't see much of that in the North. I mean, maybe very particular movies or very particular things, but, you know, there was definitely a period where Bollywood was looking at very Western styles of music. And I do find it is notable that, you know, people will say, well, I use this raga or I use this, I was inspired by this. And it's all sort of very classically rooted, even if it's not a classical composition per se. So that influence is still there.
In all the singing contests on Malayalam TV channels, you'll see before somebody starts singing, they will say the song is in this raga and this tala, which is, you know, very basic in Carnatic. That's like the building blocks of Carnatic music. And I don't think that's as prominent in the sort of Bombay-based music shows to say it's this raga and this tala.
Yeah, so, you know, from my perspective, again, I'm getting more depth and more learning out of this film that we chose to watch for the podcast.
Yeah, this is you think about this as background research for the Malayalam cinema watcher.
Never a bad thing.
I don't have a lot to say about the performances in this movie. Everybody kind of did what they were supposed to. The actor who plays the prime minister, Babu Nambudiri is his name. Innocent is also in it, but unlike most in movies, Innocent barely gets any attention in those scenes. But I feel like Babu Nambudiri is this person who's very, he plays the prime minister, the divan of Travancore. And that's a very influential role in the Travancore kingdom. You could kind of see that he wanted to indulge the king, but he's also concerned about how much the king self-indulges in music and art and doesn't pay attention to other aspects of his rule, including playing politics with the British. That was definitely a character that I found interesting. And he's clearly not a Malayali. His name is Subbarao. So like a lot of divans, prime ministers in various Indian kingdoms, they came from outside the kingdom. So they were just learned men who the king thought would be beneficial to his rule. I don't have anything more to say about this movie.
But in terms of, you know, where we're going to be going over the next few episodes, because I was doing some, you know, some thinking about, you know, what makes a period, what makes a historical film, and what's going to be important in terms of Malayalam cinema in these things. And I think that's what we've been trying to pick out in terms of the films that were chosen. So next time we're going to be looking at Oravada Kanviragata and Marakar, the big M's.
Yes.
And Marakar is too new to sort of have a legacy, but Oravada Kanviragata has a very strong legacy. I mean, that was the one, for years I couldn't find it subtitled, and that was the one that people kept telling me, you must watch this film. So we must be watching this film for next time. And anyone who wants to, you know, join us and, you know, watch it ahead of time, there's a reasonably decent print with subtitles now on YouTube.
You know, I have never seen this movie, despite it being a classic, because there's a little bit of like applauding historical aspect to this movie, even though I've been told many times that it's very, very good. So I'm excited to see what it's about as well.
That sounds good. So we'll see everybody next time.
See you next time, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Polandin Empathy podcast.
If you like what you're hearing, remember to come back for our next episode and share our podcast with your friends.
If you'd like to connect with us, you can email us at polandinapati@gmail.com or reach out to us on our Twitter feed @PolandinaPatti. See you next time.